Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking with a neuroscientist. His name is Kurt Fried. He's a professor of neuroscience up at the University of Colorado Medical School in Denver, and he's one of the world experts on Parkinson's disease. And in fact, I gather that in 1988, he was the first person to operate on a brain and put in some new cells. And this was a form of treatment for Parkinson's disease. And he's one of the few experts in the world that performs this type of operation. So, Kurt Fried, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, delighted to be here, Keith.
Before we get into Parkinson's disease, neuroscience, that's just a little about Kurt Fried. How did your science career begin?
Well, throughout my life, I was curious about how things worked. And throughout grade school and high school, I was always interested in science and decided to become a physician when I was 13 years old, according to my girlfriend when I was 13, you know. So this really was a natural thing for me to do, and I followed it ever since.
Did you have doctors, medical doctors in the family? I mean, you had somebody to say, this looks like a career? Or?
Well, my mother was a nurse, and yet she didn't push the idea of science. And my parents were always very whatever you want to do kind of people. And so each of us children decided on our own what to do.
Any other medical practitioners in the family?
Brothers
and sisters?
No.
So you're it?
Yes. No relatives that are physicians either. So
where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Seattle and then grew up in the Midwest, mostly in outside of Cleveland, along Lake Erie. And that's where I learned to sail. I built a sailboat and taught myself to sail when I was 15 and stayed a sailor the rest of my life.
Well, for those of you out there that don't know it, the America's Cup, do you follow that racing at all?
I do, and yet that is a super multi-million dollar business, and I do my best to just stay afloat.
So you went to medical school, and then was it clear straight away that you were going to have a career both in medicine and research, or did that develop slowly?
Yeah, basically, I entered medical school with kind of an open mind about what the balance would be between taking care of patients and doing research. And in fact, my training is in both internal medicine residency, but also in psychiatry. And so I think if I were practicing medicine full time, I'd be a psychiatrist just because it's so interesting to interact with people and people's brains.
And it's pretty open-ended, too.
Yes.
You don't seem to come to hard and fast conclusions very quickly. So let's get on then straight away to neuroscience and then Parkinson's. Just tell our audience what does neuroscience encompass and then get into the Parkinson's specifically.
So the neuroscience is the field of study of the brain in biologic terms. So there's psychology, which actually looks at behavior, and psychiatry that looks at abnormalities of human behavior. And neuroscience is actually saying how do our brains really work? How are the nerve cells connected? What can go wrong with them? How can we fix it?
And so, I mean, just thinking about that for a moment, you read these stories or articles or statements or aphorisms. The normal human being uses such a small percentage of his brain. I mean, is that a reality?
There are very strange calculations involved in this statement that we don't use all of our brains. Actually, what is beautiful now is we have techniques where we can put a person into a scanner without any pain or injections, and we actually can see how the brain is working when a person is listening to music or reading or thinking or getting stressed, that sort of thing. And different parts of the brain light up and the pattern changes continuously. So that business about fractional use of the brain is simply preposterous.
Okay, well, that's good to know. But you can't go higher. I mean, we don't use it all. Are there parts of the brain that when you do that type of an experiment never seem to light up? And how does it light up? What makes it image? Is it electrical impulse?
What's interesting about the brain is that it tries to conserve energy. So the brain has some way of saying, I'm about to start using this part, and then it supplies more blood to that part of brain. And so that changing blood supply is actually what we look at with these imaging techniques. So the brain really does slow down to use about 50 watts of power when we're in a real resting state, and then it can go up to about 100 watts of power during active, well, let's say, exercise. And interestingly, exercise, physical exercise, involves more of the brain than essentially any other activity. All of the things we think of as our human smart part, talking, thinking, and so forth, use regions of the brain. But the most comprehensive use of the brain is as we're doing serious physical exercise.
So when I'm sitting there reading the literature, and it's particularly painful because I'm not understanding and I've got to keep going back, the brain, most of it is dead and there's just this little part that's working. But when I go out jogging, running or something, the whole thing is lit up.
Yeah, so a part of the brain, and when you're reading, will be on the left side of your brain, and it'll be like having the desk lamp on next to your chair in the living room. The rest of the room is dark.
That's interesting. So what are the major issues that you decided to study once you got into the brain? I mean, Parkinson's is what you're well known for. You're a pioneer in the area. Did that come slowly, or did you sort of jump into that?
Well, I told you I was interested in psychiatric diseases. And at the time I was starting research 30 years ago, you couldn't really do research on these important human diseases like schizophrenia and depression. You just can't get inside a person to do that. Whereas with Parkinson's disease, and you could study this in animals. So it turns out that rats and mice have a form of Parkinson's. They can, with drugs, be given a form of Parkinson's. And then those animals respond to drugs just like people with Parkinson's. So the key to making progress in research is to be able to study an animal model in which you can actually, at some point, take the brain apart and then see what's happened. And with humans, of course, we can wait until death and autopsy, but much more limited information than we could get from animals.
Tell us then, what is Parkinson's disease?
Well, Parkinson's is a disease in which a tiny number of brain cells have died off. The number of brain cells would fit on the head of a pin, about 500,000 cells. It sounds like a big number, but compared to the total number in the brain, it's tiny. They make a chemical called dopamine, and every creature, from fruit flies to snails to people, need this chemical dopamine to move. If you don't have dopamine, you cannot move. You cannot initiate a voluntary movement. And in fact, your whole body is kind of frozen. So for reasons that are unknown in most people, these cells die off, leaving the rest of the brain pretty normal. So starting in about 1967, there was a drug called L-DOPA that was devised that could be taken by mouth, get into the brain, get converted to this chemical dopamine, and it produced miraculous ability to move, that people who had not moved for years could take this pill and then start walking around.
And this isn't just, say, mobility, but I mean also speech, because there's a muscle somewhere in the tongue, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah, so all voluntary movements, yeah. And, you know, walking, but also swallowing. You know, the upper part of our esophagus requires us to start the process, swallowing and speaking, even moving the face. Parkinson patients actually can look younger because they don't have wrinkles in their face because they can't move their face.
So anyway, so they discovered this drug, and it had good properties.
Yeah, so this drug, L-DOPA, is still the most important drug for most people with Parkinson's disease. It's the most powerful drug, and it's been successful for more than 40 years.
Does it have side effects?
L-DOPA has some side effects. If I just gave you a bunch of L-DOPA pills to start taking them, you would get nauseated and maybe even vomit. And yet people get tolerant to that side effect, and then there's some other adjustments to the way the pill is taken to reduce that side effect. The biggest problem long run for people with Parkinson's is that instead of taking a pill and then going from being frozen to moving normally, people will start moving but then have too much movement. Their arms will start flailing around, and as they walk, they may even lose their balance because their excess movements are throwing them off balance. Most Parkinson people prefer being able to move even if it's even if it's too much, to being frozen. Being frozen is a very disturbing and disabling situation.
In fact, we have friends, and one of the other corollaries with Parkinson's, I gather, is depression. Is it biochemically related, those two problems, or does the one just produce the second?
Well, dopamine is important for lots of behavior, humans and all other creatures. So it's fundamental to help us move, but it also is responsible for mood. So low dopamine is actually a cause of depression. The abuse of amphetamines is really trying to increase the amount of dopamine that is being released. Cocaine and amphetamines cause release of dopamine, and that produces euphoria in some parts of brain. Parkinson's is not treated with amphetamines or cocaine. It just simply doesn't work. And yet we have this other side of our brain, this mood and mood state ranging from depression to euphoria that dopamine controls.
So then the DOPA was a drug still used. In fact, the majority of Parkinson's patients use this. But you've sort of stimulated and initiated this whole new approach of injecting, well, I don't know if injecting is the right word, but providing new cells to the brain. Would you like to talk about that just for a little bit?
Yeah, so starting in the 80s, we were doing research on putting new brain cells into animals to see if we could get around the need for drugs by supplying dopamine with cells that actually made dopamine. These are replacement cells for the cells that have died off. A group in Sweden showed in 1980 that fetal brain cells of a certain early development time could be transplanted into rats. This is rat into rat, and could relieve a rat form of Parkinson's. So my lab started working on this and saying, can we do the same thing in people? And so by 1988, we'd worked out the techniques enough in animals so that we put human fetal dopamine cells into the brain of a Parkinson patient. This is the first patient in the United States to receive such a transplant. And we do literally bore holes in the skull and put long needles into the brain and inject these cells in a certain pattern. And those cells, surprisingly enough, will grow and can replace the need for drugs. This has been done with a neurosurgical colleague of mine, Bob Breeze, at the University of Colorado. And he and I have done 61 of these patients over the years, the largest group of any group in the world.
Where was the very first implant done? You said you were the first in the United States. Where was the initial trial?
So the first implant was actually done in Lund, Sweden, in the year before we did a transplant.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and we're here with Professor Kurt Fried from the University of Colorado at Denver Medical School. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. Norbert, listen to the names of these medicines. Dr. F.G. Johnson's French female pills. Or how about Dr. Salwan's magic Nervine pills?
You can't be serious.
There were a bunch of these, and they were sold from the 18th to the early 20th centuries. As a group, they were called patent medicines. Untested medicines sold in shops, traveling medicine shows, and through mail order.
The term patent medicine originated in England as proprietary medicines whose ingredients were given government protection. Among the early ones to arrive in America were Daffy's Elixir Salutis for colic and griping, and Dr. Bateman's Pectoral Drops.
People found patent medicines for just about any ailment without a prescription. These products made outlandish claims, but did they really work? And what was in them? Recently, a group of researchers sought to find out by testing 50 of the hundreds of products.
Most contained vegetable extracts and a lot of alcohol. Others had potent drugs such as opium, cocaine, or heroin, and were given to colicky babies, sometimes with tragic results. A few, such as the French female pills, did have potentially healthy ingredients such as iron, calcium, and zinc. But even these contained lead, and others had heavy metals such as silver, mercury, and arsenic.
The patent medicine industry was lucrative and thrived unregulated until 1906, when Congress passed the Pure Food and Drug Act, and then in 1938, when medicines had to list their ingredients.
Though patent medicines have disappeared, today we have dietary supplements that also claim great health benefits. I wonder what future scientists will think of the medicines we use today.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Kurt Fried from the University of Colorado at Denver, and we're talking about Parkinson's disease and different treatments. So then you've done 61 of these implants. Now, you said that you have to do the implanting of the cells in a particular pattern, I think is the way you put it. Tell us, what does that mean? You just don't stick it in anywhere. It has to be in a particular part of the brain?
Yeah, so the brain is divided into very specialized areas. There's one particular part that controls speech. If that's damaged by a stroke or something of that sort, literally you cannot speak. Others control your ability to use numbers. And again, a damage of that area means that your numbering days are gone. Another part of the brain for vision. So the area that is necessary for movement and needs dopamine is actually deep in the brain. It's kind of right behind your forehead, but then about 2 inches deep in the brain. These are a set of nuclei that ordinarily have a lot of dopamine in them. And the dying cells that have made the dopamine are actually down near the base of the skull, down near the spinal cord. And those cells are branching out and supplying dopamine to this front part of the brain. So we take cells and we don't put them down at the base of the brain. They wouldn't find their way up, but we've literally put them in the region where the dopamine has been lost, and these new brain cells will grow and make connections and supply the dopamine.
Well, you know, for me, it's a stupid question perhaps, but okay, you're going in there halfway in the middle of the brain, but it's not like by magic. You're having to bore a hole through other parts of the brain. Does that not have some damage?
Well, it is surprising. Of course, the worst thing we fear is breaking a blood vessel on the way in, and that can be potentially lethal, you know, that you can cause a stroke by hitting a blood vessel. Short of that, we use quite fine needles, a needle that would be the same size you'd get a penicillin shot with, and that does not damage the brain. It's a rounded needle, and so the areas we're going through don't notice anything. We don't have any.
I mean, to the layperson, that sounds ludicrous. I mean, it's rather encouraging, but I mean, it goes back to that point at the beginning. There's large amounts of the brain that we don't need, at least.
Well, we're not tearing it apart. You know, no. If you were going in with a knife instead of a needle, you could have some changes in personality and a variety of other things.
Must have been a lot of practice on this. I mean, there must have been mistakes. At the very beginning, when was the first time anybody had the gall, the ganas, to actually put a needle into somebody's brain?
Well, needles are put in the brain all the time.
And now, usually, but the first person.
Yeah. Well, the first time that a needle was put in, the biggest problem, you couldn't do brain surgery before you had sterile, surgical techniques. And that was really at the turn of the last century, around 1900, 1915. That those techniques were worked out. And rather than putting in needles, of course, people were going in with knives and cutting out tumors, that sort of thing. And so in that process, neurosurgeons figured out what the areas were that you could touch and couldn't touch, that some areas are very precisely mapped. And if you do damage in one spot, then you will lose the function of an arm or hand or something of that sort. And so tumors, for example, of the pituitary gland, very deep in the brain. You say, well, how do I get to that to actually take it out? Can I go from the top? Well, there's an awful lot of stuff that you'd have to go through. So, in fact, the technique for getting to the pituitary gland involves going through the nose and the top of the roof of the sinuses there.
I'm beginning to feel a little queasy.
So each of these is by, to some extent, trial and error, but also by logic and say,
And then there's things like the gamma knife. It's a whole different type of surgery. You don't cut through the brain at all. You just focus energy on certain regions.
Yeah, the gamma knife is really CT scan or a brain scan or an X-ray scanner, and you just turn up the power. You
right.
just turn the knob to high, and then whatever you're imaging gets roasted.
And that's very effective.
It is particularly good for tumors that are unreachable, just
right.
for the reasons we've been talking about.
Right.
Particularly tumors in the base of your brain, there are too many critical things going on, like breathing. And if you cause damage there, you stop
like life.
Yeah.
Right. I've got it. Okay, so then you pioneered this technique, and now it's a commonly accepted technique throughout the country and throughout the world.
Well, the issue with the transplants is the recovery of tissue. Tissue has come from aborted fetus of a very early age when the whole fetus is only about an inch long. And that is about 7 to 8 weeks after conception. At that stage, the fetus is so fragile that it's shattered by abortion. And so this operation is rarely done and only in a couple of centers around the world. There's no one in the United States doing this right now. There's a group in Canada that is doing it. But really, the difficulty in getting dopamine cells for transplant has left us at the proof of concept phase, but this is not available for people with Parkinson's.
But so, I mean, there's an issue here that the public would like to know. There's a so-called embryonic stem cell, but that's not what you're talking about using. You're talking about cells that are already differentiated in the fetus for brain activity.
Yeah, that's right. That's what we've used up to now, and
right.
that's what we understand can be put in. The patient doesn't have to take immunosuppressive drugs like you would if you had a kidney transplant. And then we know that they will last for the life of the patient. They'll last for 10, 15, 20 years without being rejected, still doing their job. The other issue, this embryonic stem cell issue, involves early cells that can become any cell in the body. So we have shown that we can take embryonic stem cells and make the right kind of brain cell out of that, and we can cure rats with human dopamine cells that we've made from embryonic stem cells. Now there's even a further refinement. I can take your skin cells, make stem cells out of your skin cells, and then make brain cells out of that, and conceivably transplant your own skin, but now brain, into right. your brain.
How far away are we from that, Kurt?
Well, we always say 5 years, and I think that's a reasonable, not only as a prediction, but as a reasonable guess about based on the kind of work that has to be done. So we're already showing it works in rats and then with human cells and then say, okay, how many steps will the FDA make us go through? And,
right.
and that's really the issue.
And how many groups now working on that?
There are probably 6 groups around the world.
So just 6 centers in the world, and you're the only one in the United States?
No, there are other groups in the United States. There's,
okay.
there's a good group in New York, another one in Wisconsin. And yeah, so there are several interested groups in the U.S.
So to the lay person, of course, this whole business of taking your skin cells, transforming them into the stem cells that can be differentiated to anything, seems like a tremendous panacea for curing so many problems.
It's a very exciting time in research, and I think people will be astonished at what research can do over the next 10 or 20 years.
Right. What other techniques are there for treating Parkinson's?
Well, a technique that has become quite popular is actually putting a pacemaker into the brain. This is just like a pacemaker into your heart, but there's a certain part of the brain that is actually keeping you from moving. So you put a pacemaker electrode on one side for the opposite side of the body. You put in 2 electrodes, one on each side, and then you have little battery packs that are sitting out under the skin of just below your clavicle, and those battery packs pace away, and that helps you move because you're knocking out the inhibition of movement, that there's a specific site that says, I don't know what's going on, don't move. I know you want to move, you smart part of brain, but your feet are going to stay glued to the floor if I have anything to say about it. And so this pacemaker is turned on, and it says, basically, be quiet, we're not listening to you anymore.
This pacemaker is replacing the role of the electrical impulse of the dopamine.
the dopamine is a good signal, but there's no dopamine, and the dopamine ordinarily is telling this area that says don't move into saying it's okay to move.
Right.
So basically an area of brain, see the way the brain works, it works a lot on inhibiting things. And so moving,
you'd want to move,
the smart
but the
part of your brain
don't.
Says, move, I want to go from here to there. And then other parts of the brain are saying, is that okay? Shall we let him do it? If you don't have dopamine, that is an executive function, and it says, no, I'm sorry, we won't let you move. And so this area is the enforcer, and it says, okay, you're not going anywhere. And then this stimulating electrode, even without any dopamine in the system, the stimulating electrode is shutting down that area of brain that says don't move. And so, boom, people go blundering off.
So, I mean, there's a part in the front somewhere which is I don't quite know how to put this, but I know somebody very close who had a brain surgery after an accident, and all the inhibitions went away, right? I mean, he was perfectly fine, except that now he would say what he was thinking, that he would normally know, look, it's not appropriate to say that. But that had all gone. So that was the regulator not functioning.
Actually, accidents in war or war and industrial accidents have taught us a lot about the brain. One of the oldest stories is from the mid-19th century, where a guy was tamping black powder with a rod, and the powder went off, and the rod went through the front of his skull. And he didn't die, which was unusual for the time, but his name was Phineas Gage, and he said he'd been a nice church-going man and now was a cursing and irresponsible person. So that told us that the brain that was destroyed by this big rod was responsible for keeping him a nice person.
Look, we've got a few minutes left, but I want to go back to something you said, that this business of the dopamine is controlling motion. And every animal, I think you said, has this. I've always been fascinated by jellyfish because as far as I know it, they're 99.9% water. And yet they're living creatures. They move. They also have dopamine. And
so jellyfish are actually kind of related to sponges and to sea anemone and, you know, other creatures, some of which are fixed in position and others that are moving around. What is beautiful about these creatures is that they really are simple. They have kind of an outer layer and an inner layer, and yet they have to do everything that every other creature does, feed and reproduce and avoid enemies and all that stuff. It turns out that these creatures all have the same chemical transmitters between their nerve cells as do we, and that includes dopamine. It also includes another chemical called acetylcholine, a very important part of our brains.
Right.
Serotonin is what most of our antidepressants
work
with.
So we're just one more sophisticated jellyfish, really.
So we all living things, use the same chemicals to accomplish similar purposes.
Kurt Fried, it's been delightful. We've just gone through a lovely half an hour of enlightening information about the brain, about Parkinson's, and we thank you very much for being here.
Well, Keith, it's been delightful for me.
And Norma Martinez, thank you for helping us put it together again. We will be back next week with another Science Studio. Take care.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso broke ground earlier this week on its new building that will house the Gail Greve Hunt School of Nursing. Developers hope the building will be complete within 20 months. It will be co-located near the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. Read more at the Region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.